Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Bethany Gilbert, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Corumdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. Today, we're talking about stuff we're reading, which you guys both like to read.
Yes,
indeed. You both read a lot of books.
Yes.
And I think people would like to know the stuff that you're reading. So that's why we're recording a podcast about
What's great about that is I like talking about stuff I'm reading.
Nice. Yes. Yes. I don't know, though. I'm kind of reading a lot of heavy stuff right now, so I don't know if
Hey, the great thing about this podcast title is whatever you're reading counts as a conversation topic.
That's a good point.
It's not like, you know, comic books you're reading or happy books you're reading or nonfiction books you're reading. It's just books
you're reading. That's good, because all I'm reading are comic books. No.
All right, I got one to start us off, Bethany.
Cool.
I was in Philadelphia a couple weeks ago. There's a group of pastors I get together with once or twice a year. We spend two or three days together just sort of caring for each other's souls, encouraging one another, talking about what's going on in life and leadership. One of the things we always do is just trade books and talk about stuff we're reading. One of those friends turned me on to a book called The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. And I read this book in about 2 days, and it is absolutely fascinating. I think everyone listening to this podcast should go buy The Revenge of Analog. I think it was written in 2016. I'll check here and get the copyright date. So it's maybe a couple years old. Yeah, 2016. The author is David Sachs. David Sachs is a columnist. And I get the sense that this book sort of came out of some projects he was working on as a journalist, just chasing down various things. But here's the premise of the book. David Sachs wants to convince you, hey, if you listen to pop culture or even to, like, you know, what makes the news cycle, the theme is, hey, the digital revolution is taking over everything. Magazines are dead. Newspapers are dead. Books are dead. CD stores are dead. The way of the future is, you know, digital. It's Spotify. It's Dropbox. It's, you know, everything digital is where things are going. And he basically wants to convince you, actually, that's just not true. That's why the book is called The Revenge of Analog. And what he traces is, I'll read you from the table of contents, The Revenge of Vinyl. So he talks about the rebirth of the LP, The Revenge of Paper. He talks about the success of the Moleskine notebook, The Revenge of Film. He talks about the return to film cameras, The Revenge of Board Games. He talks about the whole interest in board games and, like, board game stores and places where people get together to play board games. He talks about the revenge of retail, that retail is not dead. It's very much alive. The revenge of work, the revenge of school. He's basically tracing. So I'll give an example of what he says. He says there's a company in Nashville called United Record Pressing. And if you think about what an old vinyl record was, you know, it takes a certain technology to make a record. And United Record Pressing in 2010 was running one shift of employees 6 hours a week of work. And the owners had taken out loans to keep the store open. By 2014, they were pressing 40,000 records a day. They had a staff that worked 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. And he basically said what changed was there's actually a massive demand for vinyl records all of a sudden. And he asks, why is that? I mean, it's interesting because this book is like it's sort of a tracing out of some culture realities, but then he sort of philosophizes on some of the why, you know, and he interviews people and, like, hey, why do you think this has the resurgence in this industry? And he basically says that, you know, if you think about Spotify and all digital music, iTunes, you know, all the cloud-based music stuff, what it took away from people was the joy of owning your own music. Because if you can listen to any music of any genre, anytime you want, anywhere in the world, it's sort of like, well, who cares what CDs you own or what records you have? No one cares, because it's just you can listen to anything. And he said, actually, collecting music used to be a thing that, like, it gave you a sense of, like, oh, this is something I've spent money on. This is something I own. This is a piece of music that I want to have on my shelf and display and play for my friends. And so he talks about that basically, though everybody would have said, hey, digital music killed all the analog music technology, the revenge of vinyl suggests the opposite. It suggests that, yeah, there are ways in which the digital, we'll never go back from digital music. He says, hey, when I go jogging, I like to have my music on my, you know, just like anybody else, I like to have all my music right there. But the resurgence of record players and vinyl is happening in the age group of 18 to 24 year olds, greater than any other segment of the population. And he basically says, this is the new teenage rebellion. It's like, if your parents' music is all on Spotify, where do you go to have something that's cool and niche? You go back to vinyl.
Yeah.
So the book is basically, it's interesting to me because it suggests two things. One, it's a counter narrative. You know, he says, hey, it's actually true that, like, he talks about the bookstores, the revenge of print is one of his chapters. And he talks about, so if you think back 20 years, you had like Borders and Barnes and Noble and these huge bookstores. And what they tried to do was, okay, you had the mom and pop store down the street. Like, I think about the Bookworm down the street from our new building, independent bookstore that's been there since 1986, pretty small, not a huge space. They've got some books. I'm sure they can order you whatever book you want, but it's a retail bookstore. Then you have Barnes & Noble and Borders, and they come in, and they're just trying to compete on price. Basically, you can get your book cheaper. It's guaranteed to be in stock because it's a huge store. What happened to Barnes & Noble and Borders? They got killed by Amazon, because if their marketing plan was cheaper books in stock, well, Amazon can get me that book even cheaper, and it can ship it to me in 2 days. And so, definitely, I mean, Borders is bankrupt. Barnes & Noble has severely trimmed back their number of stores. But what's growing are the independent bookstores. And he says the reason they're growing is because, again, if you can buy every book on Amazon on any subject, now the problem you have is, well, how do you know what to read? And if you think about the algorithms that Amazon use, it's like, oh, Chris, you read a book on Harry Truman lately? How about a book on George Washington? Let's get another presidential biography. It's just the algorithms are really simplistic. What people love about independent bookstores is serendipity. Like, I go there looking for one book, and then I see another book and it interests me, and mm-hmm. I end up buying it. And it's something, it's like a cookbook or something I wasn't even thinking about. It's a whole different genre. And that actually, people enjoy that kind of discovery. And so the narrative that he's telling in this book is basically, hey, don't believe the sort of line that everything of the future is digital. Actually, the future is a combination of digital and analog. And none of these analog technologies are dying. They are probably, their prevalence is dying off. In other words, there's not going to be an independent bookstore on every corner, but there are going to be thriving independent bookstores, because it's not true that Amazon is going to kill. You know, that's the narrative Amazon wants to tell, is they're going to kill all the independent bookstores and there's only going to be Amazon and they're going to take over the world and make you put a barcode on your wrist to buy stuff from them and all that stuff, you know. And
Mark of the Beast.
You know, so it's a really fascinating book. Part of why it's fascinating to me is because I just didn't know any of this stuff. I didn't know they were making more vinyl records. I didn't know about how the success of the Moleskine notebook. He basically talks about that notebook was invented in 2006, and basically it's just paper with a cover. It's just like, it's a notebook. There is zero thing
fancy though.
There is zero things innovative about the notebook. But yeah, it's basically, but they spent a lot of time thinking about the kind of paper, the design, and sort of telling a story behind, you know, the story is, this is the notebook of bohemian artists and writers. And this is what, you know, famous writers like Hemingway used to jot down their notes about mm-hmm. books they would write. And he says that story is compelling to people because there is something about ink and paper. Mm-hmm. He talks about how, like, I even think about this for myself. On my shelf in my office right now are prayer journals from my life dating back to 1996. I can go pull any of those off the shelf right now and open it up and tell you, oh, here's what I was praying about at that season of my life. If I've got all that on my hard drive, well, it's still there. But there's no chance that I'm pulling it off the shelf one day and just sort of reminiscing about it. It's like I have to go looking for it. And so it's a really fascinating read, and really sort of gave me some hope, because I tend to be like the stuff I love is all dying. You know, I like books. I like actually owning things. I like stuff that's not, you know, everything everywhere all the time. I like things that are unique and local and, you know, sort of individual. And David Sacks's book gave me hope that, oh, analog isn't dead. There's a future here. It was really, really interesting.
Yeah. What this has got me thinking about is, well, two sort of anecdotal things a couple Sundays ago before the service, when we were sitting around before prayer, we started talking about Christian music because that's what you talk about on Sundays. But someone brought up the how back in the day, meaning the 90s, we would all be excited about getting those like Christian music sampler CDs, like Tooth and Nail samplers, or
because how else were you going to hear that music?
I know. And so just that whole idea of like, man, Spotify killed the whole like, I got the sampler. And then even when you had CDs or records, you would go over to your friend's house to listen to, hey, I got the new CD. I didn't have the new CD, so I want to go over and listen to it with my friend. And so there'd be this whole experience where do you go to your friend's house and listen to this? Hey, let's go listen to my Spotify playlist. And like, that sounds a little weird. So it seems to speak towards that we just don't want products. We want experiences.
Yes.
And even with like the Moleskine notebook, like I don't put my grocery list in a Moleskine notebook. There's something, because
it's kind of sacred.
Yeah. There's something that is sort of, you know, I want this sense of, you know, depth of thought or, you know, whatever. I want to use this for something meaningful. And so, you know, the stuff that's tangible seems to carry with it an inherent meaning and an experience that I think we long for. And even thinking, okay, so if I'm going to buy this book, I shouldn't buy it on Kindle. I should actually buy
it. You should buy the actual book.
The actual book.
Hey, here's a fascinating point that he makes. He says that one of the things e-readers have done for people is you lose the psychological sense of having completed something.
Yeah.
There's something about a book when you turn the last page and you can set it back on the shelf and say, I read that whole book. That feels really powerful to people. And he says with e-readers, or even if you think about like, you know, reading a newspaper online, there's always another link for you to click. There's always something that it's going to suggest for you that you don't have that sense of completion. And so he talks about how powerful that is in the human psyche, and that it doesn't matter that it's the exact same content. There's something about the experience of reading through a book and closing it and knowing that you finished it, that people really desire. The other interesting thing, Bethany, your husband's a software developer, and he talks about a lot of software companies. I can't remember the specific one he's using as an example, but he says there's a software company that made all their designers, the first 3 days that they're working on a new project, they have to do it in a Moleskine notebook. They said, basically, you are not allowed to do anything electronic until you've spent 3 days basically drawing pictures, design, like writing out thoughts. And he talked about how the designers all love this, and now that's all they want to do is start everything on paper, because he says it basically it gives that sense of creativity, a sense of like, we're exploring some ideas here. I don't know what we're going to build. I'm just like, let's just throw some things at the wall and see what sticks. And so it's really interesting. Like, he talks about how if you go to like big tech companies like Facebook and all the Silicon Valley companies, there was whiteboards everywhere because they make everybody brainstorm in an analog format first before they compile all that and say, okay, what are we going to do with this? Because there's something about seeing things on a wall or on a piece of paper that just does something different to your brain. One other interesting story he tells, I mean, this is interesting how recent this is. He talks about back in 2008, was the first experimentation with massive online open courses. I don't know if you remember this, MOOC or MOOC was like supposed to be the new way that everybody was going to go to college. And the idea was, it was in 2008 that like courses taught at Harvard and Stanford and places like this, you could get them for free online. And so anybody in the world, and the idea was this was going to revolutionize how we learn, because instead of paying to go to Metro Community College, Chris, you could avoid tuition at all and go watch the same class at the elite Ivy League school. And why would you not do that? That was going to be how everybody's going to learn. And so they talked about how there were these companies that were created that were going to deliver this massive online open course technology. And in 2012, this really took off, and everybody thought, like, I have a friend here in town who worked for UNO, and I remember having coffee with him around that time. And he was like, oh yeah, the university will be dead in 8 years. You know, like this is going to revolutionize how we need to think about delivering education. And then he basically says, all those companies are bankrupt. Like, there's not a single massive online open course that ever worked. Do you know why? Because 90% of students drop out of them, because there's no initiative, there's no impetus to complete the course.
Yeah.
If it's available to you whenever you want it, and there's no relational connectedness and no payoff for getting all the way through the course because you paid money for it and now you're getting your money's worth. If it's just like, he basically was talking about the dramatic failure of online education and how now most of the models of education that are flourishing are like a return to old school methods, classical education, book learning, you know, reducing the number of technological devices in class. That's what people want. And there's some, why? Because that actually is how we learn. There's something analog about the way we learn that you can't just digitize.
Yeah, I think of, so my husband worked for a company based out of San Francisco, and one of his boss lived down the street from a private school in San Francisco, so in like Silicon Valley, that had a super strict, like, no technology policy. And this is where CEOs of like startups in Silicon Valley were sending their kids. And that's, yeah, that's fascinating.
That's one of the points he makes in that chapter is like, yeah, all these people are sending their kids to very analog schools. And they're, you know, they know some things about what this does to the mind. So anyways, I've told you enough about the book, but that's what I've been reading in the past week. The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter.
Nice.
So real things matter, you guys. You should invest in some real things, like some LPs or some books or some...
I'm going to go buy some vinyl.
Market. Yeah, farmer's market, whatever. So there you go. Chris, what are you reading?
So not quite as upbeat and chipper of topics. But I've been reading a lot of counseling books lately for a number of reasons. One, just to sharpen my skills as a pastor. One of the things that... Man, I loved my seminary experience, but I only took one counseling class in seminary. And so trying to fill in some of the gaps there and just learn how to be more thoughtful in the ways that I engage people. But then also even for my own soul and my own benefit of, you know, just growing in sanctification and how to do that for myself. So two books right now that I'm working my way through. One is called Unwanted by Jay Stringer. And this book... deals largely with unwanted sexual behavior and sort of what is underneath some of that.
Like on behalf of other people toward me or my own unwanted
My own unwanted sexual behavior. And really what I appreciate about this book is he is trying to get at that sexual sin is not just an issue of lust. Like I have lust and I want to feed that lust. That he's getting at... I think the biggest takeaway from this book so far is the line that your sin is not random. And what he's getting at is that the unwanted sexual behaviors that anybody has, that they're there for a reason. And the sort of the theme and the shape that it has taken is there for a reason. And so it wasn't as if, you know, boom, out of nowhere, you had a particular unwanted sexual behavior. And at the root of that is just you're a lustful person. He's actually pointing, hey, that's very much story formed in different ways. And that if you actually slow down and take time to listen sort of to what is happening in your soul and sort of the nature of the sin, that's actually how you're going to get toward freedom and allowing the gospel. Well, he doesn't use gospel-centered language, but he is using a Christian framework of how God can bring healing and sanctification. So
that's fascinating. Is he a counselor?
He's a counselor.
Background?
He's a counselor. And so he is out, I believe, in Washington State, Oregon. I think he's on the West Coast somewhere. But a lot of the book is written. So he did his own pretty extensive research project where he interviewed, I think it was well over 1,000 individuals who wrestled with unwanted sexual behavior and sort of kind of got inside what was causing it, what was driving it. And so he takes it through three stages. So he looks at kind of how your past has formed you, and then looking at current behavior and why you sort of stay there. So he uses how you got there, why you stay there, and then the path forward kind of out of it.
Is this the kind of book that's more for pastors, counselors, disciple makers, or is it the kind of thing where a person who's experiencing this could read it and have insight to their own soul, their own dynamic? Like, can someone read it and go, oh, this can help me? Or is it more
absolutely,
like, this is for me to help other people who are...
Nope, it's definitely for both. So he frames it for both. But so reading it, he addresses it as sort of you. So he's assuming that, you know, someone that has these behaviors is reading this book to get help. But he also definitely frames it out of like how to help other people in it. So yeah, it's useful no matter where you are sort of on the side of needing help or the side of helping others.
Is it a good read? Like, is the average person going to enjoy this read as... Enjoy might be the wrong word. Are they going to be helped by... Is this like a book that's easy to read, or is it like, eh?
No, it's well written. I mean, I think it's definitely written at a very accessible level. If you're going to read this book, I would say a couple things about this. One, you definitely need to read it slowly, because he's driving you towards reflection. He's driving you towards getting inside your story and kind of slowing down and listening to things that you maybe have never listened to before, or asking questions you never asked before related to your past and related to kind of why you're doing kind of what you're doing in the present. The other thing is you definitely need to read this with somebody, either a pastor or, you know, some faithful brothers or sisters that are going to help you process, because the last thing in the world you need to do is process your own story by yourself.
In isolation.
Because that can just get really weird. It can also be very despairing.
I was going to say, it could get really discouraging.
Yeah. So you definitely, this is definitely a book that you want to invite other people into or read with other people. I'm reading with a couple other guys. And it's very helpful to have plenty of space to dialogue. But be prepared to go down roads that maybe you've never gone down before, either because no one's really led you that way, or maybe you've been too afraid. So it's definitely a challenging read in that end, even though, you know, as far as the accessibility of the book is, you know, it's pretty easy to read.
All right. Sounds like a fun one.
Yeah.
What's the other one?
So the other one I'm reading is called The Soul of Shame, by Kurt Thompson. So Kurt Thompson's a psychiatrist in the Washington, D.C. area, and he's written another book called The Anatomy of the Soul. And what is great about Kurt Thompson is he is mixing really good theological thought with sort of the latest research on neurobiology. And so he's combining those two fields to really get inside the sort of spiritual physical dynamic that we face. And so in The Soul of Shame, what he is doing again is kind of walking through kind of the nature of shame, but he's looking at it from a neurobiological standpoint as well as a theological one. And what's brilliant about the book is he's getting at how our stories, again, kind of how shame and the way our stories have shaped us, that we often think about this very much on a spiritual level, which we should, in sort of the level of belief, but we often miss that it actually is affecting us physiologically, and it's affecting the neurochemical pathways in our brain. And so that we need to recognize that working through shame is both a spiritual exercise and a physical exercise. And what does it look like to believe truth and to be sanctified by the Spirit and the Word, which he's got a great gospel lens, but also, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, really this embodied spirituality that has the effect of reprogramming and affecting our brain and sort of the neural pathways that take place. And so, you know, if you've read much on that and how habits are formed and behaviors are formed, there's the physiological aspect of that. So he's trying to weave those two things together. But again, a lot of this is story form. Like it's getting into how, you know, stories have shaped us and experiences and trauma and pain have shaped us. And it's, you know, I've heard some people push back on, and even with unwanted push back on, hey, this is kind of narrative therapy. You know, you just sort of retell your story and, you know, okay, whatever, you know, whatever pitfalls and narrative therapy has, there's also a lot of, I think, common grace wisdom here. But I wouldn't necessarily call what Kurt Thompson is doing is narrative therapy. He's more just trying to emphasize this connection between the spiritual and the physical.
And is that, it more of an insight book, meaning like having read it, I would walk away having a greater appreciation for that? Or does he provide any like walking me through what does it look like to deal with shame actually?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So he's a good counselor. And so I would put it largely in that second category. Now, here's what I would say about Kurt Thompson, if for some reason he ever found this podcast.
Hi, Kurt.
he's a decent writer, a very good speaker. So I would
say, in other words, the audiobook, the audio version of this in lecture is going to be better.
Yeah, I would actually say there's actually some of his lectures on this content on YouTube. And he's lectured
Chris,
and taught.
This is a podcast about books, man.
Oh, I'm sorry. I know.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Keep going.
No, it's good. It's good. But anyway, it's so I would give...
Does it seem like it was probably lectures that got turned into a book?
Yeah, that's a good... Maybe.
In other words, like he taught on this stuff first and then maybe sort of condensed it into a book.
I could see that. Yep. The Anatomy of the Soul seemed much better. I would say it was a little bit better written than this book. So all that to say is I'm not going to, you know, hey, man, this is the greatest book ever. And
Is he a theologically orthodox guy? Like, yes, do you feel like his theological grid is good?
Yes, absolutely.
All the people who are listening to this are like, oh, man, counseling stuff is always flaky and theologically
not
shallow.
Not flaky. Yeah, okay. I believe he's a good Anglican brother. He has done some adjunct teaching at RTS. So...
Shout out to my alma mater.
So he's, So, you know, he's not going to, you know, be teaching a bunch of.
He's a theologically reformed brother.
Yes. You're safe there. But again, we'll challenge maybe some of the categories. If you've, you know, sort of thought about some of these things in just sort of one way. So yeah, those are kind of the heavy readings that I'm. Been going through. And
hey, thanks for sharing those are actually really helpful. Mm-hmm. I've not read either of those books, so I'm intrigued by just your description of them. Thanks for letting us talk about our reading, and maybe we'll do this again in a month or two when we have another set of books on the coffee table.
I'm gonna read a bunch of just like, you know, shallow science fiction novels to talk about.
I was thinking maybe like
time.
Some young adult fiction.
I was going to say.
Twilight. Or...
I could give you guys some suggestions. I'm joking. The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We love to hear from our listeners, so if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next Wednesday for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.